All right, tonight we are in Exodus 22. So as of right now, we are halfway through the book of the covenant, which God gave to the Israelites at Sinai. So a specific people, a specific nation at a specific time, right? He gives this book of the covenant. It's Exodus 20, 21, 22, and 23. So last time we talked about personal injuries, right? And what we said was that what God is doing, He's giving His people, the Israelites, a law that is going to set them apart from two other types of people. The first type of people, or the first group of people, is the Egyptians whom they left behind in Egypt. And so we saw that last time. We spent a lot of time talking about slavery and that sort of thing, and why slavery, you know, is even in the Bible, right? But those laws, for example, are intended to set the Israelites apart from the Egyptians who were behind them. A lot of these laws are also going to be intended to set the Israelites apart from the Canaanites that are before them, right? Because the original intention was for the Israelites to come out of Egypt, go to Sinai, go into Canaan, right? We know that that is actually not what happened, and we got to go through the rest of the Pentateuch to figure out why that happened, right? But again, a lot of these laws will set them apart from the Canaanites whom they will experience and ultimately dispossess in the land of Canaan. Okay, so that's where we're headed. So last time, personal injuries is where we ended up. Now, as we begin in Exodus 22, we're going to start talking about property rights. Property rights. So Exodus 22, beginning in verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If this thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. Let's stop here. We're going to go pretty incrementally tonight because these are kind of sundry laws and they deal with different situations. So clearly what's going on here is God is addressing the commandment, you shall not steal, right? The 8th commandment that back in Exodus 20 verse 15. Now, the first thing we should see is that stealing is not immediately a capital offense. Right? So murder, for example, is a capital offense. Stealing is not. That doesn't mean that it's not, you know, it's a lesser of the Ten Commandments, right? It just means that as we know and understand from the law, there are different grades, okay, of law, right? And we see this based on the consequences. So in this particular case, for stealing, not a capital offense. And that makes sense, right? I think because at the end of the day, if a person is, something is stolen from them and that person is immediately killed, well, that person has suffered a loss that will not be regained, most likely, okay? And so in some sense, we see the wisdom of this in that a person who is stolen from actually gets to recoup what is stolen when the thief is identified, all right? And that is, I would argue, just, all right? So here we have in verse 1, the man steals the ox, slaughters it, or sells it. That is, he's clearly attempting to hide his sin. He has to pay back 5 or 4 times, right? And so one could argue that the reason the ox is 5 times and the sheep is 4 is because the ox is actually much more valuable, right? So the ox is something from which you get work, right? So it's kind of a tool in a sense, right? Okay. Now, verse 2, if the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. So think about this, right? So if somebody's walking through your house in the middle of the night, the owner has a right to defend himself. In the dark. And we see that in our own judicial system today. But if the sun has risen on him, verse 3, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. That is, if you see who this person is, just because this person is in your house and is about to steal from you does not give you the right now to murder that person. Okay? And then he, the thief, shall surely make restitution. And then we saw this last time when we were talking about slavery. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. That is, in order to recoup the thing stolen, he will be sold into the employment of the person from whom he stole it. Again, justice. And if what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, this is in contrast to verse 1. Verse 1, he's trying to hide his theft. Verse 4, he steals something and he's using it, say an ox, right? And if it's identified and in his possession, he still has to recoup, but this time only double. Okay, so there's a less heinous aspect of stealing in verse 4. Okay, make sense? Verse 5, if a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. So this is, right, so the assumption here is that you have two people who are living next to each other, right? One has a field, the other one has a field, right? And person A's animal decides it's going to graze over in person B's field, right? And the law says, hey, that's not fair. That's not fair. Okay? Now, in the New American Standard Version, it says, if a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare, okay, it's not clear to me that actually, that my bare is in italics. That means that bare is actually not there. All right? And so I would argue that if your translation does not have bare, let's say, this is, I think, assuming that person A's field is not grazed bare, right? And yet, that person A's sheep or whatever grazes into someone else. Hey, like, feed your own sheep, right? So I think the bear in the italics here is actually not helpful in this particular case. And it's not in the text, so that's okay. All right? Again, justice being done, this is a form of stealing. Verse 6, if a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. So these thorn bushes, what are they for? Well, they are sort of the their fences. That's what they are, right? And so this is not necessarily to keep others out, but it is to keep your animals in. Okay? Right? And we'll see later in the Pentateuch that a person should not be picking their fields all the way to the corners, if you're familiar, right? So that the poor can come and pick in the fields of those, right? So you don't want to pick all of your grain, you want to leave some of it for the poor. So the thorn bushes are primarily here to keep the animals in. Now, if a person starts a fire in the corner of their field, right, they're burning their trash or whatever, and the thorn bushes catch on fire, and remember, as fences, these thorn bushes would most likely be between two fields, between person A's field, person B's field. Person A starts a fire, catches the fence on fire, and then that fire sweeps into person B's field, then person A will have to make restitution for the crops that are lost in person B's field. Okay? Again, justice being done here. Verse 7. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid hands on his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, or for sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. Okay, so this is, again, verse 7, if a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, right? So this is one man holding on to something for something else, and it's stolen. The thief, if he's caught, shall pay double. Again, we're into property rights and stealing. Okay, still talking about the eighth commandment. Okay, if this stuff, which was kept to hold, is missing, and the person who was holding it claims it was stolen, and you can't find the thief, now what do? Right? Now we have a situation where we have one man's word against another man, right? I gave this stuff for you to hold, it's gone, now what do? Well, you take it, now the New American Standard reads the judges, literally, it's before God, okay, before God, that's what in verse 8, and then in verse 9 twice. Okay, it's literally before God. And you determine those judges who are acting in the place of God, right? And this would be like that Romans 13, subjecting yourself to authorities, right? There are no authorities but those whom God has put into place, All right? So you go before God, and you essentially hold a trial before God. And there's some interesting things here, right? So, first of all, in verse 9, you have, and so there, verse 8, they go before the judges to determine whether or not the person who was supposed to be holding onto this stuff has actually stolen it and hidden it for himself. That's the accusation, right? So, if person A gives person B some goods, and then those goods disappear, and person A says, person B stole my goods. And person B says, oh, it was stolen from me, but you can't find the thief. All right, now what are you going to do? You're going to go before the judges, right? And then in verse 9, they say, this is it, right? This is what I'm missing, right? And here's the bottom line. Verse 9, he whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. Now, what's the implication? The implication is, at trial, either person might be found guilty. So person B, who was entrusted with this stuff, might be found guilty of stealing. Person A may be found guilty of what? Making a false accusation. And if person A is found guilty of making a false accusation, he shall pay person B double. And so justice protects both parties. Protects party A from having his goods stolen by his neighbor, and person B from being falsely accused. Okay? Very, very important. And we see that in our own judicial system. Right? If there's an accusation, a lawsuit being made against a person or a company, and the judge rules in favor of the person being accused, then the original accuser is forced to pay the legal fees. And this is intended to keep the litigation volume down. Okay? The person who makes the false accusation does not get away scot-free. Very, very important and just. Written right in here into God's law, and that's the law that we have taken on in many respects in our judicial system. Okay? Or else people will go around making false accusations all the time. And by the way, this is for a different time after the recording. This is exactly what's going on in our society right now, is that people are out and about making false accusations, okay? Or at least making accusations. And the culture assumes that the person against whom the accusation is being made is automatically guilty. That is not justice. Whether the accusations are false or not should be left to the judges. Okay? But there is no assumption of guilt up front. Right? That's why in our own jurisprudence we say things like, a person is what?
Innocent
until they are proven guilty. And if they are proven to be innocent, the accuser has to pay. Very, very important. Comes right from God's law. If a man gives his neighbor, verse 10, a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies, or is hurt, or is driven away, while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them, that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. Hey, you gave me this donkey to hold on to, and it wandered away. I didn't take it. It's of no benefit to me. Right? And so, the person shall not make restitution. He makes an oath. So not only now are we dealing with the eighth commandment, you shall not steal, but we're also dealing with the third commandment, because that oath is assumed to be taken in the name of Yahweh before the judges. So now we have the eighth commandment and the third commandment. Okay? And that's why the warning in the third commandment is, don't take an oath in Yahweh's name in vain. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what it says. For the Lord, this is 20 verse 7, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. That is, if you're going to go stand before the judges, literally before God, and take an oath saying, I did not lay hands on my neighbor's property, you better be careful. Better be careful. Because the Lord himself will not allow his name to be trounced in such a way. Okay? So the reason, and this is another important principle in God's law. Okay? This is very important. The default judgment in God's law is to release the guilty rather than punish the innocent. I'm going to say that again. God, in his law, his default judgment is always to release a guilty person rather than punish an innocent person. We will be going through God's law, Lord willing, as we go through Leviticus and everything else. That is always what you will find. Why? Why? Because the ultimate judgment is left up to God. And God says, okay, human courts are imperfect. And so God says he's going to default to allowing a guilty person, okay, a guilty person who's going to make an oath, right? Let's say person B, who was supposed to be holding this property, right, stole it, hid it under the rug or whatever it is. He goes before God, before the judges. He makes an oath that he didn't steal it. God's law says there's no restitution. Why? Because on the day of judgment, that same guy will literally stand before God and be judged for bearing false witness. God is not in the business of punishing innocent people for no good reason. He is in the business of allowing guilty people to go free occasionally, because at the end of days, he will ultimately judge them. Okay? Very important principle. Think about it. We can talk about it later if you want. But it's very important. And you can see that right here in verse 11. Verse 12. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. What is going on here? Well, if it was stolen from him, right, then he wasn't actually watching it. Right? Mm-hmm. He was entrusted with it. He wasn't watching it. He shall make restitution. Okay? And then verse 13. If it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. This is a continuation of verses 10 and 11. It wandered away. It got torn by some beast. Hey, this was your donkey's fault. Okay, it wasn't stolen. It wandered away. It got torn to pieces. Here's the evidence. All right? So that verse 7 through 13 is if a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him. All right? Verse 14. Now, if a man borrows anything from his neighbor, different. Okay, this is not just holding. This is borrowing. Think of a donkey. Think of an ox. Okay, he's taking it and using it. Right? If a man borrows anything from his neighbor, and it is injured or dies while its owner is not with it, he shall make full restitution. If its owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for its hire. Right? And so, just these situations, right? If I'm going to borrow an ox from you, and I'm going to take it from you, right? And it is injured or it dies while it's in my possession and the owner's not there, I got to make restitution for that. If the owner's over, I'm borrowing it, but let's say the owner is moving it through the field, right? And the owner is there, right? The assumption here is that the owner made the mistake. Mm-hmm. The owner made the mistake. Okay? And there's no restitution necessary. Okay? Think of either an ox or a horse. Okay? The assumption is that if the owner is there, the owner owns it. The owner makes the mistake, no restitution. All right? If the owner is not there, then the person who did the borrowing must make restitution. Because maybe he was using it incorrectly. Right? You ever lent somebody your car? Okay? Are you riding shotgun or are you not? If you're not, you fully expect that person to compensate you. If you're riding shotgun in that car, which you lent to that person, the assumption is that you are governing how this car is being driven. Okay? That's the situation we're in. All right. Now we're going to transition. There may or may not be a paragraph heading, Okay, about verse 16, mm-hmm. But this is a bit of a transition here. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. All right. What is going on here? What's going on here is that this is a law that God has put in place to suppress what? Fornication. Right? This is not rape. That will come later in the Pentateuch. This is a suppression of fornication. The assumption here is that the virgin, the young girl, who is not betrothed, because that's also a different situation, but the young girl here, who is not betrothed, is in on it. And so what God is saying is, hey, you young couple, if you are not going to do it in the order which I have prescribed, that is, a betrothal and subsequent marriage, and you're going to go do it out of order, you will be married. And the guy has to pay a dowry. And these dowries are serious change. They're serious change. Okay? And so the person who really has to think about this is the guy. Am I really gonna do this? Because if he engages, he's in. Okay? And he's either in for lifelong marriage, monogamous marriage, or he's in for the dowry anyway with no wife. Again, some serious change. Right? So a guy, as he's going to engage in this type of behavior, this law is intended to make him stop and think and stop and think some more. Right? Because God is not going to allow this fornication to go on in this nation that he is building with his law. You're going to do it out of order, it's for life. Okay. Interesting though, the father has the right to refuse. All right, and again, this is just who's the one who really is in need of protection here? It's the woman. It's the woman. I'm not saying she's not all in, but I'm saying the woman needs to be taken care of. And if she gets this, let's say, reputation, and the guy throws her away after the fact. She's going to have a hard time finding the next guy. Okay? Again, cultural issue, right? But she's going to have a hard time. And God says, I will not allow that to happen. I will not allow the women, right, this misogynist, megalomaniac God of the Old Testament, I am not going to let the women in the nation Israel be used and thrown away. They will be provided for. And they will either be provided for by marriage to the man who engaged in this behavior, or they will be provided for by their father plus the dowry. But I am not going to let these women be uncared for in my country. Okay? By the way, I was joking about the misogynistic megalomaniac. That's what the skeptics say. Right? It's the woman who's being cared for. Verse 18, you shall not allow a sorceress to live. We heard some of that maybe on Sunday morning from Acts chapter 16. I don't think I need to expand on that. Whoever lies with an animal, verse 19, whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. I am not going to expand on this one. It should be understood as to what's being described here. There will be additional laws coming later in Leviticus on this particular topic. This about sums it up. Okay? Suffice to say, it is a heinous sin. A heinous sin. That's why it is a capital offense. 18 and 19. And 20, by the way. He who sacrifices to any god other than Yahweh alone shall be utterly destroyed. Devoted to destruction. Devoted to destruction. Shall be treated just like the Canaanites will be treated once Joshua takes them into the promised land. They're pagans. They're worshiping demons. I will not have it. They will be utterly destroyed. So there you have 18, 19, 20. capital offenses. No questions asked. Not a lot of words in the original Hebrew. Okay? Not a lot of explanation needed. Verse 21. And you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. All right, so a couple things here. Number one, verse 21, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. If you will do me a favor and skip down to 23:9, you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you are also strangers in the land of Egypt. These two verses act as bookends in some way. Okay, so there it begins and then ends as a reminder that the Israelites should be gracious to the sojourners in their land. Gracious to the sojourners in their land. One might even call them immigrants. Okay? And the reason is because, again, God is setting apart his people from whom? Well, it's right on the face of the text. The Egyptians. The Egyptians treated you, my people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, poorly. Like, unspeakably poorly. You shall not act in that way. You shall not act in that way. Okay? I think what's behind this is an inherent assumption that those sojourners are not pagan idolaters. The point here is we're looking at ethnic Israel, non-Israelites. Ethnic non-Israelites who want to come and join themselves to the nation Israel. Because we will see later in the Pentateuch that God is explicit about the fact that people who are Gentiles who come in to join themselves to Israel, who want to worship Yahweh, the one true God, they shall have the same laws as the ethnic Israelites. They are equals. I mean, think about Ruth. Right, who's brought back into the nation Israel, for example, just as a simple biblical example. Okay, if they come in and they're pagan idolaters worshiping demons and they're trying to lead Israelites away from the one true God Yahweh, then we know what happens to them. That's taken care of in verse 20. So we're talking about non-Israelites who want to come in and join themselves to be worshipers of the one true God. Right? We should treat them just like you treat each other, and certainly do not treat them like the Egyptians treated you. That's not how we're going to roll. All right? Now, then he moves on, 22 through 24, to widows and orphans. Right? Widows and orphans. We have talked about this on Wednesday nights before, but this is really important. Right? Again, the gracious and merciful God. Right? As we mentioned previously, back in verses 16 and 17, God is concerned to care for those who are the weakest among us. I mean, we would just argue, frankly, on a physical strength argument that the man is stronger than the woman, right? The woman needs to be cared for. We see this all through the text. Right? And now, he's worried about widows and orphans, people who literally cannot care for themselves. The nation is commanded to be caretakers of these weak individuals who cannot care for themselves. And then look at this word of judgment, 23. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, this is the orphan, I will surely hear his cry. Listen, verse 24. And my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. That is, if you do not take care of the widows and the orphans, then I'll kill you and make your wife a widow and your kids orphans. I mean, that's serious. And you can read, especially in the minor prophets, like I think Amos comes to mind. You can read in Amos the judgments that come against Judah and Israel explicitly. For they're not taking care of the widows and the orphans in their midst. So God, as he brings his judgment down on Israel the Assyrian captivity, on Judah and the Babylonian captivity, he explicitly says judgment is coming because you will not take care of the weak among you. And it's right here, the warning is here. And this is exactly what God does. Verse 25. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, it's very important, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets, for that is his holy covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. So, again, God, in his law, taking care of the weakest among them, that is the poor, widows, orphans, unbetrothed virgins, and now here just generally, the poor, who are occasionally finding themselves in need of money. Okay? And again, there's a much longer conversation to be had about is charging interest ever right? And that is something that Christians have wrestled with for centuries, right? And the answer is not always that it's not right. Okay? And that's why I pointed out in verse 25, where it is always wrong to charge interest to someone to whom you have lended money, is if that person needs money because they don't have any. They're poor. What God is protecting against is the use of usury, U-S-U-R-Y, or the charging of interest to keep the poor what?
Poor.
To oppress the poor, just like the unbetrothed virgin, just like the widow, just like the orphan. A sly businessman who is not, verse 27, gracious like Yahweh, will use interest to trap the poor. And if you think that doesn't go on in our culture, think again. Think again. That's what's being protected against here. And again, there's a much longer conversation about, is it ever the right thing, ever the wrong thing? And these people have wrestled with this in many, many ways. Right? At the end of the day, if you lend something to someone because they are poor, you should take great care, right, with this particular law. And then in verse 26, if you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you're to return it to him before the sun sets. Why would a person give you their cloak as a pledge?
Collateral.
But they would give you their cloak because it's all they have. Again, who is this person? He's poor. He's willing to give you the cloak off of his back so that he can go do what, for example? Okay, eat. I'm thinking work. This is a guy who is living day to day. He's making a denarius during the day. He gives you his cloak as a pledge. You give him, I don't know, let's say a plow to go do work in a field. Right? And let's say the plow gets stuck in the mud. He can't get the plow out. And he comes to you and he says, I need my cloak back, because if you don't give me my cloak back, I'm going to freeze to death tonight. Your plow's in such and such a field. I know exactly where it is. The owner and I, we're going to get it out first thing tomorrow morning. And you say, where's my plow? You'll get your cloak back when you bring me my plow. Guess who's listening? Yahweh is listening. Because you are not gracious, but he, in verse 27, if that person cries out to me, he says, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Okay? This is the oppression of a poor person because you can. Know this, God hates it when the rich oppress the poor because they can. This is a serious deal. Right? And this has massive implications for our culture. Not just in interpersonal relationships, but in the political sphere and in all kinds of other spheres, in the business world. Okay. And people will be judged. Rich people will be judged for their oppression of the poor. It's right here on the face of the text. And that judgment will not be gracious. It will not be merciful. It will be just. And I think about the parable that Jesus told of Lazarus and the rich man. Right? So this is not Exodus 22. This is the Gospel of Luke. This is our Lord speaking about how the rich will be treated for their ignoring and oppression of the poor. Verse 28. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. It's interesting because this particular law, which doesn't really need a lot of explanation, but this particular law is quoted by Paul in Acts chapter 23. If you want to go look at that, it's very, very interesting the situation that Paul's in there when he's dealing with this particular law. He's on trial. Verse 29, you shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. What's the principle here? The principle here is that God deserves our first and our best. God deserves our first and our best. All right? Now, there's lots of implications to this, for things like household budgets and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of questions that would follow. Okay? Because he's not just talking about money here, I don't think, from an application perspective. Okay? Should be no secret to us that David says, I will seek you in the morning. Right? So, there's a larger principle here. Right? But remember that God, right, because of everything that He has given to us, right, there's a general principle here that God deserves our first and our best. And of course, you remember the firstborn of your sons, verse 29, you shall give to me. And you've seen this previously, right? And this is a reminder, right? It's a reminder of the tenth plague, if you remember that conversation. Okay. Verse 31, and you shall be holy men to me. Therefore you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. And really what's underneath this is that, first of all, there's a cleanliness issue. Okay? But secondly, it's pretty much guaranteed that this animal that's found out in the field torn to pieces, its blood has not been drained correctly. And we will see later the principle that the life is in the blood. Right? And there's not to be any blood eaten. Okay? And so this particular animal that's out in the in torn to pieces, there's no guarantee that there's not blood left in it somewhere. Right? Because if you're gonna let something's blood, right, there's a specific process for that. Right, you take great care to make sure there's no blood left in that animal. All right. Generally speaking, this is a holiness issue. This is a cleanliness issue. Right? You're not a pagan. Don't eat an animal that has been torn apart. That's not how we do business. Okay? All right, so what did we see tonight? We saw property rights. We saw some what people would call sundry laws, just various laws of different kinds, right? You saw the seriousness of some of these things, right? The sorceresses, the bestiality, the pagan idolatry, right? We saw justice, right? We saw justice in the case of things that are borrowed, things that are given to keep, things that are stolen, right? And we see that God goes out of His way in His law to make sure that the weakest people among us are cared for. Right? The widow, the orphan, the unbetrothed virgin, the poor in general. Right? And these laws are in place because We are not gracious. But God is. And when those people whom we oppress because we can cry out to Him against us, we should be very aware that God is listening. Okay? Next time, we will finish up, Lord willing, the Book of the Covenant, Exodus chapter 23. So it'll begin again with some various laws. Then it'll move to the Sabbath. And then it'll talk about the national feasts. And then we'll move in and we'll see whether or not we get through the whole chapter. But then God is going to talk about at the end of Exodus 23, the coming conquest of the promised land and how God is going to allow that, cause that to happen in His divine providence and by His sovereign mercy to the people whom He has called out of slavery onto Sinai. Okay? No.